You're listening to Munch, a podcast and website where we pair meals with movies. I'm Ben.
I'm Andre.
I'm Leanna.
And this week we are here still talking about the Fast and Furious franchise. And because we are in the thick of Munch Fast Week, and we just watched Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift. And very fortunately, we actually have two guests with us for this podcast, none other than Francis and Richard Chim. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
And to Francis, welcome back.
Yeah, welcome back. If listeners, you may remember, Francis joined us for the Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince episode of this, which I think we were all a lot. We were fans of that episode. That was a fun episode.
Yeah.
But Francis,
fans of every episode you do.
Yeah. There's some that are a little rough.
We have our favorites, have the ones that we just don't talk about.
It's safe admitting that.
We're learning.
Yeah. So Francis and Richard, if you could give a brief introduction about yourselves for our audience.
Yeah. I'm Francis Chim. I am a writer and arts organizer in Seattle. And you can find me on Twitter at F_E_CHIEM, as in Mary.
Sup, y'all. Thank you for having me. I'm Richard Chim. I'm the author of a book of short stories called You Private Person. It's being re-released this year by Sorry House Classics.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, thanks, brother. And you can find me at just richardchim.com. And my Twitter handle is @giganticanovel.
And we are excited to have you on this podcast.
I would love to know why you guys wanted to be here for Tokyo Drift. Because I believe you knew that we were doing Fast Week, and we knew that we hoped that we would have you for at least one episode. And so I'm curious what it was that this was the one you
picked. If I remember correctly, I kind of opened the option to pretty much all the movies to you, and yet here you are for Tokyo Drift joining us.
Yeah, Ben messaged me and asked us when we wanted to get in on Fast Week, and I asked Richard, and he said, "Oh, we have to do Tokyo Drift." I think it's interesting from a like writing standpoint, the retconning that happens in the franchise, like where this movie fits in the timeline, and Richard is like a fast scholar. So I'll let him discuss his fascination with Tokyo Drift.
Yeah, it's a high bar. I was going to say, like, I think Tokyo Drift has, like, a lot of, like, haters. Mm-hmm. And people really hate on Tokyo Drift.
Totally.
And that just makes me, like, love it even more. It's like, it's a real pivot point. Like I said, like, because in high school to me, like, the first movie came out, it was good. Second movie came out, that was cool, you know, got some Ludacris in there.
Yeah.
But then, like, it just died off, I thought.
Yeah.
And the third one just felt like some last chance or raw thing. But then to me, it was a big deal because Justin Lin, Asian American director, huge deal. And just like little things, like there was like that random song by the Teriyaki Boys.
I thought it was hilarious.
It works really well. A lot of the songs are just so good.
Yeah. What was the one where you were like, they're just spelling the word Barracuda now?
Yeah, I know, right? I think it's Come On, Let's Do the Barracuda.
Yeah.
And then they just say, and then they just spell out Barracuda.
It has one sweet of those song. Memorable soundtracks.
It really does.
Yes. Yeah. Of the Fast and Furious movies.
I can't put my finger on what it is about it, why it's so memorable, but there's just so many songs on this album in particular that I listen to over and over and over again. Like 6 Days, which is by DJ Shadow, and Mos Def kind of raps over it. Like I remember that listening to that even in high school and beyond. Like it was just one of those songs that I would come back to for some reason or another.
Yeah. And every once in a while, we'll find ourselves as a blog wanting to listen to some Fast and Furious music. And almost always we turn to the Tokyo Drift soundtrack.
Yeah.
Really?
That's really interesting. Also, that one song, that one song is just so quotable. The Fast and Furious. Like that is Fast and Furious.
Drift. Yeah. Yeah. We reference that.
Yeah. That's the reference point for us when you're just making a Fast and Furious reference.
I'm going to call that our music section. That was a good music
section. Yeah.
We don't need to go into much more in-depth commentary about the music, even though it is like such a great cultural moment for the films. as well. But I think let's hop into our fast and furious moments, which we're just going to deliver what we thought our favorite fast and furious moment, and we're going to deliver it fast and furiously. who wants to start this one out? We're all just eyes around the room. I can start it out.
All right. I started one recently, so okay. I was going to give it to someone else.
Let me kick this off.
Okay.
All right. So my fast moment is going to be the race at the very beginning before he even gets to Japan. Just because there's no finesse there. It's all just about speed. And also it's just very satisfying to ultimately see the quarterback and hot man on campus, like, ultimately lose and also lose his shit. And to see him be broken down in such a simple way is very satisfying.
They make you hate him.
Oh, yes.
Like, that also is a fast moment, like, how quickly you hate this guy.
Yes.
It's almost immediate. Like, you see him and you already hate him.
And if you don't hate him, there's some soul searching.
Yeah. And you don't really like Sean Boswell yet either.
Oh, no, you hate him too.
But you still hate him less than the quarterback.
It's funny because he starts off as such a bad driver. Like, you know, he got his his driver's license probably weeks ago.
Like, he knows how to go fast.
And that's that's it. He knows he's got a lead foot.
The driver's license test in the Fast and Furious world is a little different.
Right.
They just, if you can get under a 12-second quarter mile,
mm-hmm.
you got your license.
Yes.
He also doesn't even know what drifting is.
He doesn't.
He's pointing towards a dictionary when asked about it. So.
Yeah, Bello had to define it for him.
Right? Yeah.
Do you need a dictionary now?
He didn't really define it for him. No. If we want to be honest. And as for my furious moment, I think my furious moment is going to be the how kind of rough the crashes in the film seem, just across the board. Like, between when one of DK's kind of cronies drives into the opposite lane and kind of collides headfirst with another car, I feel like that's a rough and furious moment.
That was intense. And the then cars just crumpled.
Yeah, and it's like a 10-car pileup by the end of that.
With seemingly no consequences.
No.
No. I mean, he was never seen again, right? Like, he for sure died.
Oh, I never really thought about that.
Like, I didn't see him in the final race.
I feel like after watching 5 and 6 before, like, having watched this film, we're so used to seeing such a high body count that it, like, doesn't register.
Yeah, like there was maybe 5.
Yeah.
Maybe 5.
Yeah, that's a bummer.
Yeah, those are my two moments. Who wants to...
I'll go. I've got mine. Fast moment, I'm thinking of the big race down DK Mountain when DK has fallen down the cliff and
Lakitu picks him up.
Yeah, right. Puts him back down. No, when Sean Boswell has like come further, trying to do this fast and furiously. He's going further down the mountain. He's racing, and then DK's car is dropping right in front of Sean's car, and it goes into bullet time. And he like maneuvers around the car and across the finish line. It was very so fast they had to slow down to see his decision making. That was pretty cool.
That's a cool moment.
And furious moment was probably, I think, when DK shows up, having found out that Han was stealing money from his operation, and he shows up at Han's garage and he's just furious at his brother figure. And Han was playing it really cool, which I think made DK even more angry. So I think that was the angriest I saw anyone get in this movie.
I thought for a second that you were going to take my furious moment because it also involves DK, which for our listeners who may not know this, DK stands for Drift King.
Mm-hmm.
So the Drift King shows up.
It doesn't stand for Donkey Kong.
No.
They even have like a Donkey Kong joke in this film.
With the bananas?
No, like Sean Boswell specifically says, I don't know, Donkey Kong? And then Lil Bow Wow comes back and is like, no, Drift King.
As if that was a foregone conclusion.
Yeah. And I think it's supposed to be funny, but it's just kind of like, yeah, okay.
We think that the writers in the writing room played a lot of double dash while they were slipping off and not writing for this movie.
That's how they got all their stunts.
Yeah.
Anyway, my furious moment also involves DK just showing up. And mine is when he shows up at the like rooftop barbecue that's happening with Sean Boswell and Han and like all of their friends. And he just shows up and he just starts punching the shit out of Sean Boswell because he found out that he went on a drift date with his lady friend. And like everything prior to that had been pretty chill. And he just shows up and makes the movie very furious all of a sudden. And it was quite a tonal shift.
Mm-hmm.
And then my fast moment is I'm going to go with, I debated making this my drift moment, but I'm also going to make it my fast moment. There's a scene where Neela, who is Sean Boswell's love interest, she takes him on a drift date. And there's some very good car choreography where they're drifting down a mountain. And it's just very beautiful. And I think this is one of the only fast car scenes where they're not playing some sort of like yelly screaming music or like really hard like electronic beats. But it was very melodic and calming. And yet they were clearly going very fast. Mm-hmm. So that's my fast moment.
That's a very fast moment.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoy just the repetition of that scene. There's something very satisfying about it.
The cars look like they're floating. It's almost like a dream.
Yeah, it really is.
It's really beautiful.
And the music helps with that.
Totally.
It's surprisingly beautiful.
Well, I'm going to go in a slightly different direction for these, so I hope that's okay. My fast moment is the longing glances shared between Sean Boswell and Han, where I think Sean is quickly realizing his bisexuality. And my furious moment is more of a thematic recurrence than a single moment. Just that I was furious that all of the driving scenes in which women were driving were very low stakes.
That is word. I feel that.
Yeah.
There's a personal furiousness.
Mm-hmm.
That's a new take on the furious segment. I like it.
Yes. Thank goodness for getting guests in this podcast.
Yeah.
I don't know how we would have done this for seven whole episodes. All right, Richard.
I think my fast moments were, I'm a big like Han fan.
Mm-hmm. Who is
Who isn't? Yeah.
Most of us. No, I feel you.
Yes.
But just like not like any high drama moments. I appreciate him because he's just like super, super just chilling, right? We were drinking every time, like, he was, like, eating.
Yeah.
And I just appreciate just, like, you know, the calm and serenity of just, like, taking a slow bite. You know, everyone's, like, speeding around you, going crazy. And we even talked about that moment where he got in the elevator alone. I think, like, that's my fast moment. Just this weird...
You gotta go slow to get back to being fast.
You gotta go slow, you gotta go your own way. Go your own pace. I don't know, he's a little weird. But we all know why he's that sad and weird at that point, at that moment. And I think my furious moment is like when he got jackhammered by that car, which is supposed to be, well, there's like a revisionist history that happens later, but like he dies that. Yeah. That's like crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think like him.
I think that's like, normally at this point we would move into the section where it's either welcome to the family. I don't really think we have anyone to welcome to the family.
You're not going
to
welcome Sean?
Yeah.
I wouldn't consider him family.
I don't think he is.
Like,
no. He's like a third cousin.
Yeah, like Han is referred to as, specifically is used the term family in this film, but like there's never a moment where Sean is part of the family. And I don't think Han has like the right to introduce Sean to the family.
No, I don't like Sean enough to even consider.
I think Han was trying to make his own family, or like I don't know if Han was running like a garage for troubled teens. Like, it kind of felt like
that's he was filling some void, right?
He was. He like needed a family, and maybe he felt like these kids needed him or needed racing or something. But
I like that interpretation of it.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's another interpretation garage that's a little darker. So I definitely like.
Yeah, yours. Okay. Let's go with mine.
But yeah, so we don't have any one to welcome to the family, but we do have our section that we call the Dearly Departed. And it's kind of who we lost in this specific film within the franchise itself. And so last episode, we talked at depth about Giselle and just how much that death is hard. And we have the unfortunate occurrence and like unfortunate task to then follow that up in talking about Han's death.
I think this time around watching the film, because the first time we watched it, we watched three after two. And so you're sad to see Han go, because anytime he's on screen, you're like, he's endearing in a very uniquely Han way.
Most of.
Yeah. And it's hard to see him go, but the experience this time was different because in my mind, I was like, at least he'll be reunited with Giselle and they can be together again. Because in this movie, he seems kind of detached and he's not all the way there. And he's not he doesn't have the same level of humor that he has in 5 and 6. And so, you know that he's still hurting. And so it's nice to know that where he's going now, he won't hurt anymore. So it was still hard to watch, but I felt a sense of closure, I think, this time.
Yeah. Like, I definitely don't see him as someone who would be, like, he's not someone who's afraid to die or to, like, he's lived a full life and he's done a lot of things. And, like, I would recognize that even he recognizes that he has had some very close moments with death itself. So he seems like someone who would ultimately be accepting of the fact that death is coming and it's, she finally takes his life away.
So he was caught stealing from the Yakuza. And that's why like people doing were coming
side deals.
Yeah. Doing side deals. But he just made $11 million. Like, why is he
doing side deals?
Doing side deals for, you know, a small backpack of cash.
Could I chime in? But yeah. Like at this point in the storyline, we don't know. Like if you watch 1, 2, and then 3, you don't know he has like 11 mil, right?
Right. You don't know that, but if you watch it, you know, 6, 2.
But like, But I think that's like the whole like why I think Tokyo Drift is so weird as like a narrative standpoint.
Uh-huh.
Like Han's death also like emotionally like significant. It's also significant like an industry standpoint, like a business franchise standpoint. Like they made a financial decision when they did what did they title for? Fast and Furious. Fast and Furious. They cut out the thus, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They chose to like, okay, how do we want to revamp this whole thing?
Yeah.
Let's go back just a few years. Cause they like chose to bring Yun-Sung back, like, as Han.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, like, an active business decision. So they had, like, stories for this guy to live on. And so, therefore, had, like, I don't know. I like the idea that they had this, like, what I thought was, like, somewhat of a shitty movie at the time, Tokyo Drift.
Mm-hmm.
And they made his death even more significant as more movies got dropped.
Yeah, like, his experience in 5 and 6 is ultimately brings you to love him even more. And so in looking back on his death in 3, it hurts all that much more.
Yeah, well, you realize, kind of going off your point, Richard, that everyone talks about how ridiculous the timeline is in Fast and Furious. The whole reason they do that, I don't see any reason they mess with the timeline other than to get Han back in the movies. Right. Like, that's the only reason that 4, 5, and 6 take place before Tokyo Drift is they didn't want Han to be dead yet, because obviously that was like the one chord that Tokyo Drift really struck with its audience, that like they wanted to continue in the series.
Yeah.
No other characters, not even Sean Boswell, like resonated as strongly.
Right.
Not even Sean. Surprise. Or Bow Wow for that matter.
Yeah, or Bow Wow, yeah.
Yeah, which is like, I think an exciting implications, just that like, is a major Hollywood franchise, like big budget franchise, that brought back an Asian male character that is like allowed to like be masculine and have sexuality, which is like not something that is seen very often in mainstream Hollywood action movies. Like it's just kind of the trope of like the Asian man is the like de-sexed and like comedic relief character. And I think this is one of the reasons why, like, as someone who doesn't enjoy a lot of action movies, I love the Fast franchise, just because it breaks free from a lot of like the Hollywood like racial tropes and allows actors from varying backgrounds to really have like interesting arcs
and different characters from what they're typically cast in, which is really nice. Like, you even get a nice dynamic between Roman and Tej, and that like both of them have their moments and they're both very distinct and unique characters, which is really nice.
Can I drop a bomb?
Yes.
My bomb is, I don't think there's another character like Han, like in American cinema. Just the simple fact that he's an Asian American male, and he's like attractive. Like
perfect hair.
Perfect hair.
Really we all hair. Wanted to run our fingers.
Yeah, I know. I do. I still do. But like, yeah. Like I grew like growing up, it's like Romeo Must Die, and like was like a movie I can think of with like Aaliyah and Jet Li. Mm-hmm. And then there was no one with like Chow Yun Fat, and I don't remember the actress, but it was The Replacement Killers, and very like similar like tropes where you have like male leads, and like and they're badass, they like kill everybody, but there's like no, there's no love interest. It's all out of a sense of like honor. Basically, like the dudes don't kiss the girls at the end of the movies, and I always thought growing up that's like incredibly fascinating, because if this like if Jet Li in Romeo Must Die was like Jean-Claude Van Damme, they'll be banging in like Act 3.
Yeah.
So having a character like Han was incredibly significant, just because you have this dude who's not only like sexy, he's like inherently sexy.
Yeah.
Which is super trippy too.
And the film is completely, in the film, all right, I'm going to expand out from just the core films, because there's also a moment in Los Bandoleros, which happens before 4, correct?
Yes,
before Fast and Furious. And it's a moment where Han is at a bar and he's just sitting there, and he is purely just staring at a lady sitting across from him, and that like, they barely have much of a conversation, but they are so into each other that they just end up heading upstairs. And like the opportunity for, like, when do you ever see that for an assumed, as you said, an assumed Asian American character? And it's
to be clear, you never see it.
Yeah,
I'm a movie geek. I never see it unless it's like imported. Unless it's a foreign film. American produced, you don't see it. Han is a singular character.
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement that Han is just something special. And at least from what I've seen online, like there's this kind of unanimous, like Han is like a unique character within the family that like is hard to replace.
Do we know what he's been up to as an actor since this?
I
want to see more of him. Like, I want more. Even if he's not Han, I want more.
He is really great.
I'd be curious if he's playing the same, like, kind of cool, aloof, wise kind of character. And sexy.
He plays it so well. Yeah.
He does.
Yeah, I feel like he always has a toothpick in his mouth, even though he never does. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a snack.
It's just the snacking.
Yeah, it's a snack.
One of the other interesting points that Ben brought up while we were watching that I thought was worth exploring was just the fact that this is an American-made movie about Tokyo, and Ben pointed out that the shots of Tokyo were never there weren't any like overhead establishing shots, and that it all felt very like compact. So it was it was filmed in a way that was an unidealized feeling Tokyo. Did you want to expand on that point at all, Ben?
Yeah, it's and I think it might be just more to the effect that early in the film they show this very yellow and sun-drenched America that is
and very rowdy America.
Yeah, very rowdy. and they specifically show these long lots of homes that are in the process of being built.
Future suburbs.
Yeah. And like, I imagine is some kind of subtle commentary on the process of building the American dream and how it's stagnant and at a moment where it's not flourishing and it's just kind of stopped and like how I could be looking way too much.
No, most of it, but
it's so overt in what it shows of America. And so, and it's a very wide open American, like expansive. And I think it's, they wanted to show a Japan that felt a little claustrophobic. And so it is those tighter shots. It's that street level view. And kind of everything like that. I think it's an interesting contrast to show Japan as being claustrophobic, even if that isn't maybe necessarily new. I think that is.
It's very different from all the other, every time they go to an international destination in the other movies, there are like 60 grounding shots of the same buildings to just really hit home that, yes, we're in Rio. Here's Christ the Redeemer. Here's Christ the Redeemer. It is again. We're still in Rio. Like
And you see the entire landscape. Like,
yeah.
Or like we were just in London and they were like, here's the London Eye. Here's that building that's shaped like an egg. Here's like
here's the shard. Here's,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's very
there's
different.
Even a shot of Big Ben in that.
Is there a shot of the Millennium Bridge?
I think so.
All right.
I think so.
So we have been fortunately enough to be sponsored by Corona. I wish. can I get in legal trouble for saying that? I probably could.
I think it falls under parody.
I was going to say sarcasm. So
yeah, most definitely.
yeah, it falls under sarcasm.
So sarcasm is legally protected.
Especially when we're talking about sarcasm right now. After that, I think.
We're driving the point home.
I think we covered you.
So we have been counting the number of Coronas that appear in the Fast and Furious films, and I'm not even going to go through like the song and dance of setting everyone up and then having us all say the number of Coronas that appear in this film at the same time, because I'm very surprised that 6 movies into this franchise, only 3 films have had Coronas in them, and Tokyo Drift is not one of them.
Well, if all the movies do not have Coronas in it, I'm not that surprised.
Okay, but they did go out of their way to have rock stars, which had the American label on them. So
well,
they
had it twisted so that you couldn't see the label except for like the R.
I knew what it was.
Okay. Also, that was the weird thing.
To me, that's just advertisement.
Later on, there's a car that is branded.
Oh, yeah, it's like wrapped in it. Yeah.
All right. In that case.
We're talking about product placement. Let's not forget at the beginning of the movie, the poorly CG'd Tabasco bottle flying through the car.
They spent like no time on that. That was like a teenager in his room fooling around with Photoshop's 3D effects.
Well, speaking of teenagers, maybe the reason why there was no Corona was that everyone in this movie was supposedly a teenager. We all know that Sean Boswell is actually 34, but he's supposedly 17.
Supposedly.
And he would not. He
got held back once or twice a year.
Yeah. He would not be able to drink a Corona, so he could not have one.
You know who can drink a Corona without getting drunk? Vin Diesel. Is this, Leanna, I know this was a tough one. At least in my mind, this is a tough one for Terminator Watch. Leanna's Terminator Corner. But do you have something to update us on?
Yeah, you might as well play the music.
All right, Andre, you know what to do.
Okay. All right. I wonder if you know.
I wonder if you know about Vin Diesel as the Terminator.
Oh, wow, that was it.
That was it. Yeah, you're just supposed to start talking.
Okay, yeah. Well, I can never tell with you guys. Okay. You're so inconsistent. That's okay. Right. Welcome to Leanna's Terminator
One thing
Corner.
You can count on is we're consistent at being inconsistent.
That's
consistently
so true.
Inconsistent.
Okay, this is the section of Fast Week where I talk to you about new evidence surfaced in these movies about whether or not Vin Diesel is in fact a Terminator. And this was a tough one because he's only in the movie for about a minute at the very, very end. And so I'm going to be honest with you. I am not going to be able to provide the same groundbreaking journalism I've been able to the past couple of nights, but we'll give it a shot.
These stories are written over months, not a couple days. So
we
can't fault you for that.
This is more like Serial than, you know, like breaking news on a Tuesday night. So anyway, one thing that I know, having seen every single Terminator movie ever made, is that Terminators are extremely good at tracking people. And so I think they tend to show up when you least expect it or in the nick of time, but they're just always there. And they always know how to find the person that they're looking for. So I'm going to say one piece of evidence is that Vin shows up at the end of the movie and he happens to show up in the right city at the right street race looking for the right person.
And also with the right car. And we commented on like the amount of time it takes to ship a car overseas.
So. Yeah, it's not easy. But if you're a Terminator, I feel like you can get those types of things done a little bit more easily.
Counterpoint. So. Counterpoint, and I'm sorry, but I'm gonna.
Wow, just, really?
Yeah. If you Google Teen Street Race Japan, like there can't be more than one result.
Teen
right?
Street Race?
Yeah, because that's what it was.
Tokyo's a pretty big city, yeah, man. Okay. I think there's more than one. Right.
Okay. Jeez. Okay, well then in that case, it's impressive.
Can
it's
we get about, a quick Google yeah, check on that?
344,000 results on just the videos under Teen Street Race Japan.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
First one is a 38-second.
See,
not a video. You're looking for like events.
But if you're you're a Terminator, though, you could do that Google search and like quickly scan all the videos using your like face scanner technology and find your way there pretty easily. Okay. So that's gonna be my first point. My second point is that he has a line where he says, "I got nothing but time," and if he's a Terminator, that's true.
Okay.
He's technically immortal.
Yeah.
He's basically saying, "I'll be back."
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm surprised it took us this many episodes to get that out of someone.
Thank you for bringing that to this episode of Leanna's Terminator Corner.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. That'll conclude it. We'll see you next time with Furious 7, in which I can promise you there will be plenty of evidence that he is a Terminator. So
build a full episode just about him. The next one, in all honesty.
He's wearing the same shirt as he always wears.
He's kind of like the Steve Jobs of the racing world. He just has one outfit and he doesn't want, like, street racing takes so much out of him. He doesn't want to make the decision in the morning to determine what he wears.
That's Mark Zuckerberg.
He knows he looks good in white. And the tanks show off his arms, so there's not really any other choices you have to make after that.
True that.
All right, that concludes my corner. Thanks for bearing with me this week.
Outro music?
No. Not this time.
All right, and I think that's going to call it for this episode of the Munch Podcast. Am I missing something?
Dude,
yeah,
that's Dad fine. Watch.
Ugh. Yeah. Jeez, I always forget
Dad Watch. This was a good one, too, because he was referred to as Dad by someone who wasn't actually his son.
You would think I would be on my Dad Watch game, but for some reason, I need to write it down on this Google Doc we have open right now, and I will remember for our very last episode of this. So Dad Watch, I think there's really only one man in this film that can get the award of Dad Watch, and that is Sean Boswell's dad.
Papa Boswell.
Papa Boz.
Military man.
Daddy Boz.
Navy Boz.
All of these.
Boss.
And also.
Boss.
Very, very poor father as well, because he basically tells.
Worst dad of the series.
Yeah, worst dad of the series. Because he's pretty hard on Sean in the beginning of the film, and then towards the end, he just kind of shrugs his shoulders and is like, "All right, I'm going to help you participate in this street race against the Yakuza."
Yeah, I think there's an exact line that's something like, "At least you're not making the same mistakes I did." And I think we all pointed out, like,
These seem like much worse.
This was after remember the Yakuza just had pointed a gun at his son's head. Yeah.
It was like 60 seconds ago.
But at least he's not making the same mistakes.
Cut to flashback in like the dad's mind of like him over an open grave that he just poured someone into. Like it has to get that like that bad.
But for he's a Navy officer.
Like by the time he's 18, he's jetting around, not even jetting, shipping around the world, like, he doesn't have that much opportunity.
Bad dad.
He was for sure a dad.
Yeah.
He was a military dad through and through.
He had the jeans.
He had the books. Yeah, I mean,
tell us the book.
So, all that, you should go to your dad's book collection, and if they don't have a book called Straight Stuff...
Stuff in all caps.
Yeah. They're not a dad in my book.
So we think we think the pronunciation is Straight Stuff versus Straight Stuff. Because those are very different books.
They are different books, yeah.
Wait, a little context. There was a scene where we saw... the father was scolding Boswell.
The Boswell Jr.
Yeah. And then we saw...
Boswell Jr.
Young Boswell. Ben caught in the corner of his eye. Or was it Ben?
I
couldn't help but read the
books.
You
said it pretty nonchalantly, too. You were like, on his bookshelf, he does have a book called Straight Stuff. And we were like, whoa, back it up. You gotta see that.
He, like, rewound the scene, like, three times until we all saw it.
It's just...
Worth it.
It's a weird one.
Yeah.
It's a weird book.
Oh, man. I want to interview the set dresser. Like, was that a beautiful coincidence or a very intentional piece of set dressing?
I have to imagine that was intentional. It was just perfectly placed.
It's the only title I could read. I felt like all the other books were backwards.
Like,
something.
I could read one of the authors, but that was it.
Yeah.
Straight stuff.
It's just straight stuff. And that's been this episode of Dad Watch. Another dad in the books.
Yep.
Write those daddies down.
I have one final thing I want to talk about with this movie that we haven't mentioned yet.
Of course.
This movie for me has a special place in my heart within the franchise because there is a very pivotal scene where it's right after Han dies and Sean Boswell realizes that he's in like some pretty deep shit with the Yakuza.
Yeah.
And his best idea is to show up at their HQ and propose.
Which was a bar, and he's supposedly not of the legal
drinking. Well, that's why he just walked in, because he's 34.
Yeah, right.
So that part's not.
I wouldn't ID him if he showed up at my bar.
Also, admittedly, the laws are pretty lax.
Okay.
But he's also 34. Yeah. So he walks into the bar and just. Like, pretty disrespectfully is just like, I realize that, you know, tensions are high right now, but what if we just had one race? And he literally says, like, one race.
Yes.
And if, like, he loses, he'll leave town. If the other guy loses, he has to leave town. And the Yakuza is just like, haha, sure.
No! Without taking a break and being like, wait, hold on. So you come into here. You have caused a bunch of mess for me.
Huge mess.
You hand me some money and then say...
How about
like,
a race?
How about a race?
Yeah, like, I'm not going to put all this stuff that you've messed up in my business on a race. Like, you are gambling in a way and, like, pushing your luck and trying to bid... way outside your range right now.
And he speaks in English, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
He speaks in English.
I think he opened in Japanese, and then the guy responded to him in English.
He said one line in Japanese.
And that was like the one line he learned.
Like, he talked to his friends at high school. Was like,
he didn't even know what he was saying. He was just like regurgitating it. And then once he was in, he switches to English.
I'm just imagining him like in his Japanese class, and he raises his hand. He's like, how do you say, I'm sorry, Yakuza boss, lose your money?
Let's just have one more.
This is really important that I learned this line.
And I think... And the funny thing about all this is it just works. Like, somehow this just, it works.
Like, it's because you feel that the movie's been leading up to this big race on Donkey Kong Mountain. So,
Right.
Yeah.
There is this moment, though, when the Yakuza basically says, you can go free. Yeah. And then he, like, walks, and he turns away. And he has, like, a little smirk on his face.
Like, he's somehow satisfied about the album. Yeah,
I'm like, maybe he's thinking, like, this whole fucking thing was bullshit, man. Yeah.
Like, this 16-year-old kid, delinquent kid from the States, spends about a month in Japan, somehow finds his way deep into the Yakuza ranks, wants to race my nephew's son after a crazy race through the streets of Tokyo in which one of my son's cronies dies and there's just a bunch of collateral damage. And also, on top of this, he's trying to, like...
Yeah.
Credits.
Credits. That's basically the whole movie.
That's the movie.
And somehow that just works.
You touched on something else that I thought was interesting. I think we should all go around and say what we think the time frame of this movie was. Like, from the moment he arrives in Japan to the moment he meets Vin Diesel, how much time has passed?
Word.
You said a month?
No, I'm going to
revise?
Like, I'm thinking about it now, and I'm actually going to go 6 months.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Because
there's a change of clothes, essentially, over the course of the film. There's one moment where Neela's wearing a more of a puffy jacket, and they're outside of a pachinko parlor.
Attention to detail, Benjamin.
But later in the film, they're comfortable, like, there's a fight on the roof in the school, and everyone's comfortable enough just taking off their shirts and just being in a short sleeve shirt because it's so warm outside. So a decent period of time has passed.
Or just like it's climate change. So just erratic weather patterns.
There we go.
Or that.
I'm going to go with a month. I think a month is right. And I think the majority of that month happens during the drift montage when he's learning how to drive. And the majority of the action actually only takes place in like 1 to 2 weeks. That's my guess.
I'm going to go somewhat middle ground and say 8 weeks.
8 weeks.
Richard?
I would go $1, Bob. I'm just kidding.
Let's look at the scoreboard. Is it $1?
Probably somewhere between. I don't think it was that long, 6 months.
Okay.
But I don't think it was as short as just a single month. It's weird. There was like two montages in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
that's where all the time is.
Yeah. That's where all the
it's
time
all
is.
In the montage.
Also, I think we should give Bow Wow a little love.
Oh yeah,
we haven't like even mentioned Bow Wow and his like Hulk car.
That was a cool that car. Just goes like, and I love the reveal of the Hulk car where the music just kicks in and it's like my life be like ooh,
and Bow Wow literally goes like you see him go ooh, as he sees his car and the music kicks in. It's just a nice
he
nice
is
effect.
So into his own car. Yeah. Like,
if I can quote myself,
yes, you yeah. most definitely
Bow Wow's sexuality is cars.
But he is definitely a shining light in
this. He also breaks the fourth wall. Like, he'll wait. Yeah. Like, he sings along to the song the soundtrack's playing for the movie. He winks at the camera when he gets into an elevator full of girls.
And
like,
he,
it's really weird.
And in so many scenes, because Lucas Black, who plays Sean Boswell, is such a bad actor. You would think in his 34 years that he would have picked up some acting skills, but no. Bow Wow schools him in every scene, and thank God for that, because there were some lines delivered by Lucas Black that were just truly
following awful. Bow Wow's expert performance in Like Mike, he comes in and has just a wonderful role in Tokyo Drift.
He's just really matured.
Mm-hmm. He really has.
Shout out to Bow Wow. Shout out to the flip phone.
Too. Shad Moss.
Oh, yeah. That's another...
major character. Yeah. The flip phone. Right. With streaming phone video.
Every moment was...
With an early build of Meerkat on it.
early build.
Yeah. They've been working on that one for a while, and then Periscope copied it in like a month. They must have been so pissed.
Well, that has been... another episode of the Munch Podcast. Richard and Francis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, guys, thank you so much.
Always great to have you on the podcast. We are Munch. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, and Facebook at Get Munched Up. Our content and a lot of our writing ends up at getmunchedup.com. Please like, rate, comment, subscribe on this podcast or our social feeds. Helps us out greatly. Reviews are very helpful as well. And finally, we always want to answer questions, comments, emails, like anything you may have. We'll answer it on this podcast. So send us an email at getmunchedup@gmail.com. And with that, I think 6 movies into Fast Week. And I can't wait for Fates of the Furious.
Me neither.
Can't wait.
I'm going to be so ready after 7. Oh, yes. 7's up next.
Cannot wait.